Hey, folks, welcome back to the last segment of the show. I'm Ted Adams. My co-host is Mike Williams. And we're talking today with Dr. Glenn Miller, who is a psychiatrist here in Santa Barbara. And we're talking about juvenile fire starts. And Mike's got something he wants to bring.
Well, here's a juvenile fire starters have some of the following characteristics. Curiosity with fire, obviously. Clear lack of understanding of the hazards of fire. Recent change in family life, such as a death, separation, divorce, or a perception of abandonment. History or behavioral problems, such as lying, stealing, truancy, bullying, cruelty to animals, and substance abuse. Poor peer relationships and social isolation or being bullied themselves, history of physical, emotional, or sexual abuse and or neglect, bedwetting, which we were just talking about during the break, has somewhat been disproved, blaming others and or unwilling to accept responsibility for one's actions, and then a lack of empathy, which is also an interesting characteristic. And I guess you need to be that way if you're going to do this in a malicious
point. And that's one of the common traits, as we were talking earlier in the show, between fire starters and cruelty to animal individuals, is that lack of empathy.
Doesn't that start to point to some other psychiatric
problems? Absolutely.
I mean, psychopathic type of behaviors and people that just are not...
The development of that type of personality disorder, yes.
Because I know from being on the job, you'll run into people that absolutely are desensitized from any human connection with anybody. Now, some of that's drug and alcohol abuse and over a period of time. But there are people out there, and you can see them. Their eyes will tell you exactly where they're not. And when you see those kinds of people, you know you're dealing with, A, a dangerous individual, and, B, somebody that's likelihood to be involved in these kinds of activities.
That's correct.
But the eyes give it away. Ted.
I think I'd like to go back to the doctor for this and reiterate a little bit about how it is that we best identify and at what time this kind of behavior and what folks can do to thwart it, you know. And I think we've been over this before in the program, but I think it's really probably the most important part of it.
And I agree. That's the critical part. That's what the takeaway, if you would, for the listeners today, is that early fire play needs to be intervened with a minimum, if you would, of education, at least with education. If that doesn't work, the interventions need to be stepped up. And whether it's initially, it's education at home. I mean, just teach your children when they're little about the dangers of fire and fire play and that things can get out of your control and those kind of things. The next thing you can do is to help, if someone has a fascination or you find is playing with fire, help them out. Take the matches, take the lighters, put them away. Get them off of the coffee table. Get them up in a cabinet that they can't get to or have to really work hard to get to, like we do with poisons or other things.
Firearms.
Right? Firearms, exactly the same way, because to them, this could be their version of that. Then in other things, you need to yourself set a good example. Okay, be cautious. Be attentive to fire. So when you're out there lighting the barbecue, don't be just haphazardly throwing lighter fluid on it and watching the thing flare up. I mean, that's going to fascinate the young child who's standing next to daddy, watching daddy, if you would, play with fire.
Right. Okay? And it's a good educational opportunity.
And it's a good educational opportunity. And then finally, as I mentioned earlier, is don't stick your head in the sand. Okay? If someone is playing with fire, and you're aware of it, and you don't say something, you don't do something, to think that it was a one-time deal and it's not going to happen again is foolish. So be on top of it, be aware, and be attentive to that kind of, at least initially, if it's play, then play and intervene. If it's something more than that, then get them the help they need.
Thanks, well, if their parents listening now and they're saying to themselves, you know, that sounds like my son or daughter or whatever. It tends to be a boy thing, but not necessarily. How can they get a hold of you?
Well, they can contact me at my office. Mm-hmm. And my office number is here in the area, 805 area code. The number is 965-4005, 965-4005. And I have my practice here in Santa Barbara. But if other things come up, they can always call our local fire departments. They're a wonderful resource. The men and women of our fire department I can't say enough good things about them.
And they are there to help, and they want to help.
And they want to help, yes.
And, in fact, they're the ones that have brought this issue up to us to continue to address as the mm-hmm. local fire agencies sitting. Because they're in people's homes in different ways than the general public is.
Right.
And they see the darker side of reality. Also, the schools have
absolutely.
Counseling.
And so parents need to know there are trained professional people out there to help them. But they have to come to us because we don't know the children necessarily that are the potential risk.
And I think the parents need to understand that there is no real social stigma attached to this. I mean, the thing is that the stigma will be attached later on when it gets worse. And now's the time to nip at the bed. It's just part of the educational opportunity. And nobody's going to point a finger at your child or at you because of this behavior.
That's absolutely right. That's absolutely right. It's an education, and everyone that we can educate early is one potential fire setter that we've taken out of the population. Absolutely.
And that prevents injuries and property loss and fatalities and all the things that go with fire.
And again, as we pointed out early in the show, that the vast majority of those that are injured and killed in these fires are the fire setter themselves. So if it's your child, do something.
Absolutely. Well, thanks, with that thought, we're at the end of the show. Thank you very much, Doctor, for taking time out once again to be with us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
A couple other ideas for the future shows. Visiting today with Dr. Glenn Miller, Juvenile Fire Starters, the topic, with Ted Adams and Mike Williams. On the board with us today, David Jay on Community Alert, Not If But When, Positive Preparation for Disaster. Until next week, you're listening to KZSB AM 1290. The news is next. See you next week.
This has been Community Alert, Not If, But When. Positive Preparation for Disaster with Ted Adams and Mike Williams. Community Alert is produced by the Wildland Residents Association, San Marcos Pass Volunteer Fire Department, and sponsored by the California Fire Safe Council. Technical support for Community Alert provided by Richard Dugan and Jim Williams. Community Alert, Not If, But When. On KZSB AM 1290, your news press radio station.
Welcome to Community Alert. Not If, But When. Positive preparation for disaster with Ted Adams and Mike Williams. Keeping you informed on how to get ready and be prepared. Tuesdays at 11 a.m. and 9 p.m. and Saturdays at 1 p.m. on AM 1290, the Santa Barbara News Press radio station.
Hey, folks, welcome to Community Alert. I'm Ted Adams. My co-host is Mike Williams. Today, we're visiting again with Dr. Glenn Campbell, who's a psychiatrist here in Santa Barbara, and Glenn Miller. I knew I was going to do that. I told these guys I was going to do that.
I love his
sure
music.
Enough, I did.
It's because you said you were going to do it.
Name is Glenn Miller, Dr. Glenn Miller, and we're going to be talking today about fire starting and some other psychiatric anomalies that we can be looking for.
Starting with forgetfulness?
who knows what that's all about. Mike, pass it on.
Let's jump into the announcements. A couple of Fire Safe Council announcements. State California Board of Forestry and Fire Protection Natural Resource Agency, sometimes better known as CAL FIRE, holding a hearing on May 16th at 10 a.m. in San Diego. This will be the County of San Diego Board of Supervisors, North Chamber, 1600 Pacific Highway, Room 310 in San Diego. Be talking about the new proposed fees, SRA fees in California. If you're interested in participating in this, again, that'll be on May 16th. If you have questions, go to the State Fire Safe Council website. That's firesafecouncil.org. Also, along the Fire Safe Council here locally in Santa Barbara, Thursday at 9 o'clock at the American Red Cross on Upper State Street, County Fire Division Chief Bob Bell talking about the funding issues and the Citygate reports and what have you as it relates to Santa Barbara County Fire. These are all big issues, and if you're interested in funding of the County Fire Department and where they're headed and how you can. And
highly critical for those people that live in the wildland urban interface.
Yeah, if you live in the interface and if you belong to homeowner associations, this would be a meeting to come to. I think it'll be very enlightening. And that'll be this Thursday, 9 o'clock, at the American Red Cross in Upper State Street. Santa Barbara City Firefighters 10th Annual Charity Golf Classic, Friday, June 1st. Donate Glen Annie Golf Club. Benefit for local charities. For further information, you can visit their website, IAFF525.org, IAFF525.org. The raffles and prizes. This is a pretty popular golf event. Entry fees, $150 per player. You can also give them a phone call at 680-7593, 680-7593. And that's for the Santa Barbara City Firefighters Charity Golf Classic, 10th annual on June 1st. Santa Barbara County, Don't Drink and Drive, Arrive Alive, 154 and 101 DUI Traffic Safety Corridor. Among the many suggestions, hang up the phone. Studies have shown that you're four times more likely... You're not authorized to be laughing over there. Studies have shown that four times are more likely to be involved in collisions when you use a cell phone. As of July 1, 2008, you're required to use a hand-freeze device if you use a cell phone in your vehicle. This and other information available at the California Highway Patrol Santa Barbara office. Give them a call, 967-1234, 967-1234. And red flag text warning available through the Santa Barbara County Office of Emergency Management. Simply go to your cell phone, type in 888-777. That's 888-777, and you can get your red flag warnings from there. And that's enough on the messages. We've got a whole stack more. But let's get into today's conversation with the doctor. I appreciate you coming back in to talk to us. We always get into these fascinating conversations, and it triggers more things I want to talk about. Juvenile fire starters, what are they, and where is it a problem, and where is it not?
Well, juvenile fire starting is actually quite a big problem. If I could just spend a couple minutes and go over some of the numbers so that the listeners can kind of get a sense of what we're talking about here. The statistics that were put together by the FBI going back years now, any typical, if you would, average, if there is such a thing, year, just approximately half of all fire, all arson arrests occur in minors. Okay, that's in kids under the age of 18. Of that, a third of them in any given year are under 15. And anywhere from 2 to 5%, believe it or not, are actually under the age of 10. Now, this is different. Okay, this is different than fire play. Lots of young people play with fire. We're talking about actual fire setting. This is the intentional setting of a fire by a minor. It's a huge number. When you look at the statistics further, back about a decade ago now, when you take fire setting and fire play and combine them together, there were over 30,000 injuries in the United States alone from juvenile fire play and fire setting. There were over 6,000 deaths.
Okay? Wow.
There was approximately $2 billion in damage, and there were 400,000 distinct incidents that of fires that were relayed back to minors. Okay? And of all those numbers and the millions and billions of dollars involved, probably the saddest statistic of all of them is that of those injuries, of those deaths, between 80 and 85% were of the children themselves that started the fire. So it is a significant problem. Because, and one of the challenges that we have is that because, I don't want to say all of us, but many of us when we were younger played with fire. There's an early fascination. You know, back in my generation, we were actually still burning leaves.
Sure.
In the Midwest when they'd fall. Remember, we'd pile them all up and burn leaves.
Yeah, lovely smell.
Yep. And so there's a fascination with fire as it is because even as little children, one of the things our parents do is stay away from the stove. You'll burn yourself. Mm-hmm. Stay away from this. It's hot. You'll burn yourself. Okay. So we have a fascination about this powerful entity known as fire. Okay? And that fascination often converts to fire play. Okay. So all too often, parents, teachers, other adults will have either observe or be made aware of some fire play and go, oh, well, it's a one-time thing. I did it. Other people do it. It's not a big deal. The problem is that if we don't address it early on, that fire play, if you would, will continue on and can then become fire fascination and fire starting.
So the question that leaps to mind, and I touched on this before we got into the program, but how much of this is a mental health issue, and how much of it is, and perhaps it's the same, how much of it is simply the child is yearning to get attention from the parents or from authority, or is that not a factor in it? I mean, I a lot of times I see so much of child behavior having to do with the child wanting to get the adult's attention.
It's a very good question, Ted. What the research has shown is that the answer to that question is somewhat age-dependent. In the younger children, the children under 7, 8 years old, it tends to be more about an actual curiosity. Okay? Mm-hmm. And then the curiosity gets away from them, and it's an accidental fire start. Okay, when you get to that 8, 9 to 12, that pre-adolescent age group, you start now getting a combination of the quote-unquote curiosity along with some the beginnings of some actual, if you would, psychological issues as far as issues about aggression and some beginnings of deviant behavior. By the time you get to the actual teenager, that 13, 14 to 18 year olds, it has now become a predominant mental health issue.
Okay. So when we come back from the break, obviously, there's lots of territory here, and I got some other questions for you, but it looks like we're coming up on a break here.
We're up to our first break here, visiting today with Dr. Glenn Miller, joining us again, talking about juvenile fire starters and what a problem that is. And that's not something the public as a whole is even probably much aware of, but behind the scenes, that's a big, big issue. On the flight deck today, David Jay sitting in for Richard Dugan with Ted Adams, Mike Williams. Community Alert, not if but when. Positive preparation for disaster. KCSB AM 1290, your Santa Barbara News Press Radio. We'll be back in just a moment.
Folks, welcome back to Community Alert. I'm Ted Adams. Co-host is Mike Williams. And today we're visiting with Dr. Glenn Miller, psychiatrist in Santa Barbara. And remember that we're live on the air today, so if you want to give us a call at 564-1290, any questions, we'd love to answer, doctor, talk to you about whatever it is you're interested in. And a question here, now we're talking about fire starters and children, juvenile fire starters, and of course there's a whole spectrum. We discussed it early on. Kids enjoy fire. It's interesting. They're curious about it. They see that they can do it. Then in certain cases, it graduates into more of aberrant behavior. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, when we get to the full-blown arsonist, there's a whole other bunch of sexuality issues and all kinds of things come out of it that we've heard about. So the question is it an age thing? Or is it a participatory thing? Or when does it make that change from being just adolescent or child curiosity into some sort of, and how can you tell? What signs do you look for the parents or for the adults that are supervising these children? What signs do you look for? Where's the transition? Maybe you can shed some light on that.
Well, I think it's important to realize that even if you would quote-unquote innocent fire play, still needs an intervention. Now, it doesn't necessarily need a punishment or anything, but it needs, at minimum, an educational intervention so that children learn that it's not okay. For instance, if you saw a 7-year-old smoking a cigarette, you'd intervene and say, that's not okay. That's not healthy for you. That's dangerous. That's all the things that you don't want them to do. To take a 6, 7, 8-year-old who, you know, is lighting a match or throwing a match into the bathtub or something like that, you still need to address on an educational level at minimum. What I have done and where I tell parents that we need to step that up a level is when the educational part of it has proven itself to be ineffective.
See, repeat behavior.
Repeat behavior, even though they've had the, if you would, talking to.
Mm-hmm. Okay?
And as the behaviors become more repetitive, they will tend to increase in magnitude as well. Because whatever, and there's a wide variety of the wise kids play with fire, but as they get their needs met by fire play, the need grows. I don't want to say it's truly an addiction, but it's an attempt to gain more sense of control. And if I may take a moment to talk about that development, is that the fascination with fire, as I mentioned, starts off at a very, very young age. Because we're telling kids, stay away from fire. Fire is dangerous. Fire can hurt you. If they see news clips, they talk about the big fire. And, you know, we've had the Jesuita fire. We've had other major fires. And they hear about people losing their homes. Fire is big. Fire is powerful. Fire is unpredictable. Well, children, by nature, are always trying to gain some control in their life,
right,
and wanting to control life, and because so much of their life, in reality, is not under their control. And so in fire play, they feel like they have some mastery because they lit the match, and they lit and created fire and threw it into the toilet or into the sink or bathtub, and it went out, and they're in control. And there's a positive sense of being in control. Then, like happens to many kids, one of their fire play incidents gets out of control. And now, all of a sudden, fire is dangerous, it's fearful, it's scary, because what they had control over now just came back and bit them.
Adversarial.
And what happens is that typically, in the vast, vast majority of cases, is the ultimate education for that child. They no longer will, quote-unquote, play with fire after that. The ones that concern me and should concern our community are the ones that instead of learning from that, quote, out-of-control, end-quote, event, they just up it up one more step and say, no, next time I'm really going to control it. Okay? And it's the young person with that mentality that as we start seeing them develop into pre-adolescence and adolescence, start demonstrating some of the other, if you would, deviant or aberrant behaviors that go along with wanting to take control, whether it's disobedience at home against parents and their rules, disobedience and truancy and those kind of things at school. They are trying to take control of the people trying to control them. And now fire becomes the control focus.
Mm-hmm.
And that really is when it starts getting to being a major concern and much more significant intervention than just education is required.
I also think that, and I've seen that peer pressure and when you've got children that have a group of children that they play with, and they're always looking for something that they can do to one-up each other or one-up mm-hmm. the parents, and a good way to do that is to start a fire. When I was a kid, and I grew up upstate New York, and we have a tremendous fire problem there. It's different than it is here, but it's a big fire problem. And of course, or not of course, but I grew up burning wood to stay warm and right. that sort of thing. Well, what happened was the first time that we got too close to the fireplace, or you know, we had the old Franklin stoves and things like that, Mom would take your finger and put it on the fireplace and say, "Hot." And you got a graphic understanding of what that was all about. Also, if you were caught playing with matches, mm-hmm. strike a match, put it out, put it on your finger.
Mm-hmm.
Hot. This is dangerous. And that was a graphic illustration for me that I didn't want to mess with that stuff because it was dangerous, you know.
And Ted, that's a perfect example of what I was trying to... And a much clearer message to the listener.
And that would be distasteful to some people, I'm sure, right. but graphically illustrated.
But again, that was a graphic illustration. That was, if you would, of that generation, and in your particular, your parents or your mom, that was how she was going to educate you. Okay, that was an educational intervention. That is hot, and that's what hot feels like.
Right, exactly.
And it worked.
It did. And here I am obsessed with fire today.
I don't think so.
In a good way.
But if I may, there's a couple things I want to mention. There are some myths around children that set fires as well that, you know, you hear from time to time that that I'd like for listeners to realize as well. For instance, you know, there is no, and again, this is with research, that there really is no association between, let's say, fire setting and animal cruelty. Now, there is other associations with animal cruelty, but fire setting tends not to be one of those.
Although they're both control situations.
They are both control situations. But just be a child that has animal cruelty is no more likely than any other child to have issues with fire setting. That it's more common amongst, if you would, more challenge educationally challenged kids, kids with lower IQs. It is not that just the, if you would, not so bright kids tend to play with fire and start fires.
Right.
Okay. This is across the spectrum from some that are not all adept mentally to the very, very bright.
Yeah, young scientists love to see that chemical reaction, you know.
Right. And the other one is a lot of times parents feel that, you know, if we tell kids about fire and, you know, we show them about fire, that makes them more prone to play with fire. The research does not hold that out. That if you educate them early, they are less likely to be end up being fire starters.
And I think it all has to do, and it's a difficult one for parents, but how you choose to educate your child and whether you're doing it in a reprimanding way or in a loving way or an explanatory way and all so many different ways of bringing that information to your child.
Right. And again, you know, we've looked a lot, but the scare tactics, if you would, I mean, actually, you know, fire and brimstone kind of stuff tends not to work because now you're really coming, you're butting heads on that control thing that
right.
we talked about.
Right.
We're up to our next break, visiting today with Dr. Glenn Miller, talking about juvenile fire starters, facts and myths, with Ted Adams, Mike Williams, and the ever-diligent David Jay on the flight deck for us today on Community Alert. If you have a question, give us a call, 564-1290, 564-1290. Listening to KZSB AM 1290, your Santa Barbara News Press Radio, and also on the Internet at noon.
Welcome back, folks, to Community Alert. I'm Ted Adams. My co-host is Mike Williams. Today we're visiting with Dr. Glenn Miller, and we're talking, he's a psychiatrist in Santa Barbara, and we're talking about fire starting and all the attendant situations that go with fire starting. And, Mike.
Well, we've been talking about the kids that play with fire. They're experimenting with it. Pretty much everybody in some form or another has has struck a match, or what happens if I put this in a candle, or whatever the case may be. Guided discoveries, if you will. But there's a transition that starts to take place with some people, and it's at that transition place that we need to start paying closer attention, whether it be the officials or school authorities or parents or members of the family or something, saying, wait a minute, little Johnny, he's not playing with matches. He's torching his sister's doll. You know, he's putting matches to the cat's tail. I mean, at what point do we start seeing that, and how do we prevent it, and B, what kind of interaction do we need to start thinking about?
Right. We typically start seeing that transition, if you would, from fire play to fire starting with an actual focus of some kind of harm rather than just play.
Right.
In that pre-adolescent, in that 9 to 12 age group, sometimes it'll be a little bit later, but typically that's where we see that transition from fire play to fire setting. One of the things, again, as I mentioned before, is whether or not they respond to prior educational interventions when they were younger. And if not, that's a red flag. Other red flags are things like other behaviors that go along with it. Is aggression part of it? Was he burning his sister's dolls because he really wants to hurt his sister and, given the opportunity he has in the past, hit her and punched her and other kinds of aggressive acts. Okay? So that's one thing that we have to look for. That's another red flag, along with fire setting. Other red flags are for kids that have relational problems. You know, they don't have a close peer group. They don't have a connection with one or both parents. They don't have connection with a single teacher. So they're more isolated, they're more out there, if you would, alone, lacking in that kind of social skill area, another red flag. The final one is that when there's other types of disobedient behavior and conduct problems, truancies, rule breaking, school suspensions, those kind of things, mm-hmm. another red flag. And when you have one red flag, that should get your attention. When you have two, you need to be doing something. When you have three of those red flags, it's late. It's late in getting involved in getting these kids the help they need.
Okay. Now, from an intervention point of view, from a medical perspective, how do you interact with these folks? How do you correct this problem?
Well, there's several ways, and that's obviously a very good question. One of the best ways to initially intervene, this is not after they've had right. several interventions, but initial intervention is actually the fire department. The fire department is by far the most skilled group of individuals in educating young people about fire. Okay? They do this all the time. They not only do they have up close and personal experience, but one of the things that our local fire department does, both county and city, is they go to schools and they educate mm-hmm. on a regular basis. So when you have a younger child, especially early on in that 6, 7 to 10 year old, taking them to the fire department, seeing the fireman or the firewoman in their uniform, and actually being educated is a very, very good first step. When it starts going beyond that, that's when the mental health system, the parents obviously, and then the mental health system needs to get involved. Whether it starts off with psychologists and other types of psychotherapists, and if that's not effective in intervening, then we move on up to seeing psychiatrists and other even more highly trained mental health professionals. The key is that, in general, fire setting is a symptom. It's not the disorder in itself. It's a symptom of some other significant underlying mental health issues and or developmental issues. And that's where the mental health profession needs to get involved.
So what kind of, if you were doing an evaluation of, say, a 26-year-old subject comes in and you're interviewing him and you ask him his past life, and one of the issues he presents is that he lit fires when he was a kid and had problems with the juvenile justice system and what have you, what kind of things are we looking at as far as mental health issues as people mature and become adults? What is this a precursor to potentially?
Yeah, there's only really a small percentage of children that set fires that actually come, if you would, full-blown adult arsonists.
Mm-hmm. Okay?
And that's because a lot of times with development and maturity comes some resolution, or if you would, some control of those early childhood challenges that the fire setting was trying to control and dominate. But when you have someone who has an extensive history a fire setting as a child, now as an adult, you have to incorporate that history into what they're presenting at the time. Some of those still have a lot of issues. The ones I've seen, in particular in my private practice over the last 30 years, tend to have much more issues with aggression than other types of deviant, if you would, behavior. They tend to be the ones that still, if you would, fly off the handle, maybe have a history of spousal or other types of abuse, and still have real issues with anger management. And fire, for them, was a route of, if you would, releasing that anger.
Rather than guns and knives and bats and physical, they use fire almost as a self, I wouldn't say self-medicating, but a self-correcting thing that they have to release this somehow. They're not going to go shoot you,
correct.
But they'll light your house on fire.
Let your house on fire, light your sister's dolls on fire,
right.
Light, you know, that teacher that really upset you or peed you off, okay?
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to show him. Now, you're not going to do a Columbine kind of thing, but you're going to focus that anger, that agitation on a particular individual and the object of that particular individual to get even.
Mm-hmm. Well, the motive for arson can be rather broad. I mean, it can be for retaliation, it can be for terrorism, it can be for political purposes, it can be for financial gain. Mm-hmm. There's lots of reasons, and the people lighting the fires don't necessarily fall into a mental health category, although we wouldn't have to question their methodology. Mm-hmm. But the motive for doing this is insurance check or to get back at somebody, or there's various political groups that are burning cars and trucks to further environmental issues. I mean,
right.
All kinds of
Seeking. seeking.
Yeah, right. There's a lot of that. But there is this small little group of people who are doing it for mental health problems. They're lighting wildland fires, or they're torching cars, or there tends to be a pattern.
Yes, that's true. And those are the individuals that are doing it for domination, if you would, to really demonstrate their powerfulness. Okay, that we're not talking about accidental fire startings,
right?
You know, at a fire pit, at a fire pit that, you know, the wind blew up. No, we're talking about people that set the fire intentionally, stand back and watch it ravage a community. That is about dominating.
So would you say that in this situation, these are people that are unable to feel as if they have an ability to control in other areas, and so it builds up, and then they use this particular device in order to exert their control?
Yes, that's very well put. Yes, these people tend to have challenges in their day-to-day life having a sense of being in control. Oftentimes you'll find that these people had been bullied in the past, or continue to be now as an adult, mm-hmm. might have a very dominating, maybe even you would describe bullying supervisor at work, okay? Have enough, if you would, self-control not to retaliate within the workplace, but have all this pent-up rage, and they actually project that rage into the fire that they create. And literally we call it raging fire.
I'd like to go back to something that is a lot broader than just arson and fire starters, but you were talking about social skills with adolescents, and you mentioned, I want to bring in the factor of the internet. Kids today do not interact like we all did, because we're more or less the same age group. We went out and played. We had forts. We raced our bikes up and down
climb
the street.
Trees
and we put cards in the spokes to make weird noises and stuff. We played with blocks and Lincoln logs and girder sets and stuff. Well, none of that exists today unless you go out and hunt it in a used store someplace. When we come back, I'd like to talk a little bit about how the internet mm-hmm. is playing into this, and not just with this, but in general with our upbringing of young children. Ted Adams, Mike Williams, visiting today with Dr. Glenn Miller of Juvenile Fire Starters, the topic on Community Alert, Not If But When, Positive Preparation for Disaster, on KZSB AM 1290.
Folks, welcome back to Community Alert. I'm Ted Adams. My co-host is Mike Williams. Today we're visiting with Dr. Glenn Miller, psychiatrist, Santa Barbara, and talking about adolescent fire starters and how that develops and how it might be able to thwart some of this and change those behavior early on.
Well, let's get back into what we were talking about before the break and during the break, and that is social interaction with kids today. I see the internet as being a huge issue, and while we certainly don't have the statistical data yet, conceptually it seems like we're seeing more and more problems with adolescents because of the lack of social skills that they aren't developing because they're isolated. They're all sitting in their rooms with their computers now. They're not interacting like people used to interact. And some of that's even at the school level, where we're not allowed to interact with each other like we used to. There's too many social norms and political correctness, and nature's not allowed to take its course in the development of people anymore. It's all controlled. So when you talk about people with pent-up frustration, I mean, I'm almost sympathetic. I can see why people have pent-up frustrations. They're not, the normal channels are no longer there.
That's absolutely true. It will be several years. My hunch is almost another decade before we really start getting our arms around the sociologic impact that the most recent, the last 6-8 years of technology will have impacted our children and then our young adults. And it often takes that many years or more to really see the impact down the line. But what we do know, what we do see, and what's been well researched even in the last few years, is that children are becoming more, as you point out, socially isolated, and that their communication is via technology, not so much face-to-face. I mean, we've all heard the stories. I've actually witnessed it with my teenage daughter, where she'll be texting one of her peers who's sitting at the table with us. Okay? That actually happened. Better not be happening again, but because we had to talk about that. But.
And you guys were laughing at me when I read "Hang up the phone" from CHP.
Well,
but, and so the point is that, as I was mentioning during the break, that one of the predisposing factors to fire setting is poor peer relationships. Okay? Another one is bullying. And as we had talked about during the break, in our day, and actually up until 10, 15 years ago,
right. There
was always that two or three bullies on the playground, if you would. And you either avoided the bully or you took on the bully. But you knew who those one, two, or three kids were. Now there's 30, 40, 50 bullies.
Anonymous bullies
in any given school setting, mm-hmm. who can bully via social media without reprisal and without repercussion. And so if social isolation is a predeterminant, if being bullied is a predeterminant, like the logic would tell us that when we retrospect 10, 15, 20 years from now, we will see an increase in lots of aberrant and deviant social behavior. Likely one of those will be an increase in fire setting.
And I think that it's all control stuff. I mean, the bullying thing is a control thing. You're controlling from a distance. You're controlling people's comfort level or, you know, self-esteem or whatever. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me that the internet and the social media is still going to be reflecting what we are as human beings, even as adolescents or pre-adolescent. It's still being driven by who we are as human beings, but the mechanisms are different, and so the repercussions may be different. But I think that we're still going to be reproducing. A certain percentage of us are going to be reproducing these aberrant behaviors, and certain of us are going to be nurturing, and I think as certain of us are going to be, you know, whatever. And I think that that's all present. It doesn't matter what the venue is, you know. And I can't see that you're, although the repercussions may be larger because you can get out to more people, or it may be easier for bullying behavior to manifest itself, and so you may be seeing more of that, but in the full spectrum of given population and the amount of different types of behavior that you're going to witness within that spectrum, that's not going to really change.
Yes, I agree in that I don't think we will be seeing in the decades to come a large shift in the variance in quote-unquote human behavior. I agree. But who we are as an individual is very much defined by the immediate response, or if you would, repercussion to a particular behavior.
Correct. I see that.
And what I see developing with the technology right now is that there is not the personal experience of the repercussion of certain negative behaviors.
I see that. Yeah.
And it's that continuation of negative behaviors that continues to escalate that I think is going to be at the root of some very challenging and interesting in a research way repercussions to.
I understand now, because I can see that by having a face-to-face conversation or communication with someone, you're reading so much more than just the words, and you're getting a response to your behavior immediately from that other person. Whereas you're sitting and you're texting or writing an email, you don't get any of that. All you're doing is you're mocking up something in your head and you're manifesting it on this thing and you're just pushing it out there at that person. And that's a whole different thing than having to confront the individual.
Exactly. If I were to inadvertently or intentionally say something hurtful to you while we're sitting here face to face, and I see the expression on your face of hurt.
Exactly.
You know, and I have a different response than having said the exact same thing on my iPad or the computer and sent it to you.
There's no accountability. Because if I send you something on the internet or an email or whatever, there's no immediate accountability to me what I did or didn't do.
Correct.
If I say something inflammatory enough, you're going to jump out of your chair and slam me against the wall. In concept, there's an accountability threat there. Whereas in the peace of my own room, you may not even know who I am. I'm just an acronym on a radio or on a email.
Well, I also, and maybe you can expand on this a little bit, I also think that when you have a written communication, there's a certain amount of interpretation that goes into that, which is reflecting who I think, who I am, and what my mental processes are, and my self-consideration. Right. So I read these words. I'm not getting the benefit of all the other communication that I get when I'm talking to someone, the loving look or the none of that. And so I'm reading the words, and I interpret that according to whatever aberrated self-deprecating, you know, all that stuff comes through, and I don't get that buffer of getting the feeling from the person I'm talking to.
And a perfect example would be an in-person apology versus a written apology. Because when you interpret the written word, or if you would, in this case, the typed word, you can go, he doesn't really mean it.
Right.
Because there's none of the rest of the affect, the emotion, the nonverbal cues,
the passion,
that really show that apology is genuine.
Exactly.
That would be an example. And the other thing is, as you pointed out, Mike, is that there's none of that immediacy of consequence or repercussion. And as we all know, you know, in human beings, training dogs, other, you know, it's the immediacy of a consequence, the immediacy of a response that has the most impact on any given behavior. And so when you don't see that it hurt Sally that you wrote this on Facebook until the next day or 2 days later at school, the fact that she says, you know, that really hurt me what you wrote, you kind of go, oh, well, sorry.
That was then.
So it doesn't have the impact of changing that negative behavior.
Yeah. Interesting.
Well, we're up to our next break, and when we come back, I'm going to read a couple of little characteristics of juvenile fire starters from our article of April 3rd, 2010. Visiting today with Dr. Glenn Miller, juvenile fire starters, the topics with Ted Adams, Mike Williams, and David Jay on the deck. Community Alert, not if but when. Positive preparation for disaster on KCSB AM 1290. We'll be right back.